Blog Talk Radio.
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I can't?
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I can't? Mission unstoppable. Mission unstoppable.
The unstoppable ones.
You did say unstoppable, right? You did say unstoppable, right? What is it they know that I don't? Coach Frankie Picasso takes you on Mission Unstoppable.
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Can anyone stop these people?
I sure hope not. Good evening. I am the unstoppable Frankie Picasso, and tonight we are going on another Mission Unstoppable. Tonight, into an ancient world of Toltec wisdom and how one man is using this wisdom combined with systems thinking to change how we think and act in the workplace. What would it be like to really enjoy going to work? How might you feel knowing that you are a valued employee and that your input is not only expected but desired? Stay tuned and stay close, and we'll find out when and how you can belong to such a place in just one moment. This is the Unstoppable Frankie Picasso. You are listening to Mission Unstoppable Radio. The time in Toronto is 8 p.m., 7 in Chicago, 5 in Los Angeles. I'd like to thank the good folks here at Blog Talk Radio for allowing me to broadcast over their network. And I want to thank you, you know who you are, for tuning in each and every week and making it such a joy to bring you the Unstoppable Ones. The phone lines are now open and the chat room as well, so feel free to call or write if you have any questions. The number to call is 646-595-3741. My guest this evening is David Dibble. He's a systems thinker, a management consultant, a spiritual teacher, and the author of The New Agreements in the Workplace and The New Agreements in Healthcare. Please welcome David to Mission Unstoppable. Good evening, David, and welcome.
Hello, Frankie. It's so nice to be here.
It is so lovely to have you here. You know, David, you were a young and successful entrepreneur. You had the prerequisite turbo Porsche, the wife, the two kids, the beautiful home, oodles of money. And one day you woke up and realized that you weren't happy, that you were kind of depressed. And you know, who could blame you, really?
Well,
it wasn't enough just to have things, was it? You know, what was the epiphany for you?
Well, I think we all, probably at some time, you know, we sort of yearn for the American dream, the riches and the house and, all of the things that we would associate with having made it. And I was very fortunate to find myself in that position when I was fairly young. I was 34 years old. But having had all that, I just noticed that my life still did not feel full. It felt actually very incomplete. And so I started questioning, gosh, is this it? When you have it all and you still don't feel complete, what might be missing? So it was a bit of an epiphany for me, waking up and finding out that when I had it all, I really didn't have what I was looking for in life.
So you really can say that money doesn't make you happy.
I don't think there's any data that I've seen anywhere that says that money makes us happy. I think that when we don't have money, we might sometimes think that life would be better if we had some. But, you know, actually having money, even large sums of money, doesn't seem to make people any happier.
So you were looking for purpose. It seems that you were looking for purpose and passion. And how did you find it? What happened?
Well, I had what I guess I could describe as a spiritual experience. I was sitting there kind of wondering how I got into this position of having everything that I'd ever desired and still not being happy with my life. And I had an experience that made me realize that there was much more to life than what I had thought, and I became, I guess, a bit of a seeker, and I became very dedicated to learning as much as I could about answering those big questions, you know, who am I and what's my purpose here and, you know, those types of things. So starting in about 1980 and, you know, still continuing today, I've been, I would say an active seeker and a practicer of universal spiritual principles.
Had you ever questioned it before when you were younger? Did you ever say, you know, why am I here? what's this all about? Do you remember as a little boy looking out the window, gazing at the stars and wondering about things?
I remember being young and being, I guess, being aware of the times when I really felt joy. And I just noticed that the times when I felt really joyous were times when I was with people where I could really, you know, be who I was and express who I was, and also when I was doing things that made my heart sing, mostly simple things. And I remember when I started to accumulate a lot of the things that we would describe as success. Many times I would get this glimpse or this question in my mind that would say, would I be happier if my life were simpler? So I think, you know, that kind of an intuition that said really to begin to go back to things that were simpler as opposed to things that are so complex in our society was a direction that I should consider.
I mentioned at the beginning of the show that Toltec was one of the spiritual awakenings or practices that you chose to look into. How did that one come about?
Well, I had been doing a lot of what I would call spiritual practice. As I mentioned, I was a bit of a seeker. I did everything I could think of. I had a cardinal rule when I first started on this path that whatever I was most afraid of, I would do that first. So I went to every seminar, and I spent time in teepees and ashrams and on mountains, and I read every book that, you know, was available, and I came to the conclusion after about 8 years that maybe the insights that I was looking for really weren't out there. They weren't outside of myself, and so I decided that I would do less of the things that I would describe as participating in the outside world, and I would do more inner work. So I started doing, you know, more meditation and more things to quiet the mind. And in 1990, I got a call from my wife Linda, who is just an angel, and she's sort of my scout. She goes out and scouts these things out, and then I dive in like the bulldog, you know. But she had met this man named Miguel Ruiz, and she called me, actually, when she got home, and she said, David, I've met the most amazing man. And, of course, I said, well, I'm not really interested. I'm doing more inner work. And, of course, I knew I was going to lose this battle before it even started because I've lost them all. But she talked me into giving him a call, and so I called him on the phone, and I put on my best business voice. I said, hello, this is David Dibble. May I speak to Miguel Ruiz? And he said, this is Miguel. And I went, hi, Miguel. I believe that you had lunch with my wife, Linda. She suggested that I call, and I'm not sure why, but I said that I would. Oh, yes, we should meet right away. I said, I can't meet right away. I have a whole bunch of, a lot of things on my plate, and I blah, blah. And he said, oh, no, not right away, in 1 hour. And I started laughing. I had never heard anything like that in my life. And 45 minutes later, I was in the car driving down to meet him. And
wow.
I was with him for about 5 minutes. And I said, this guy is the real deal, and this guy is my teacher, and I want to learn as much as he's willing to teach me. So I started on this odyssey, which we call, you know, the Toltec path. He was my teacher for about 8 years until he kicked me out, saying
that Miguel Ruiz wrote The Four Agreements, the book The Four Agreements, if anybody wants to go check that out as a precursor to David's work, which is The New Agreements in the Workplace and in Health.
Yeah, The Four Agreements, of course, is you know, an international bestseller. I think they've sold almost 4 million copies now, and it has really, that book, I think, has changed an awful lot of lives out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's very profound information.
It is, and it's funny though, because as you read it, it's almost like, no kidding, yeah, I get this. You know, it's a reinforcement of what we know, except we don't always bring it into consciousness.
Well, the four agreements are so simple. Of course, everybody, it's hard to disagree with any of them. If you look at the agreements, you know, be impeccable with your word, don't make assumptions, don't take anything personally, and always do your best. Well, it just seems like common sense. But the actual practicing of the agreements is a different story. It turns out to be quite challenging. And in the end, in order to really use the agreements, you have to live them. And so that requires changing the parts of us, basically parts of us that live in the mind, that are not impeccable with our word, that do take things personally, that do make assumptions, and that on occasion don't do our best.
It's hard. I mean, it is difficult. It's difficult not to take things personally because we live in an ego mind. Making assumptions, a lot of people fear the truth, and so they would rather make up stories than ask somebody, what's really going on with you here? But it's so simple, and like you said, it's so difficult. But with a little bit of practice, we can aspire to do these things. And I'm just so excited about the work that you're doing, especially because, you know, I come from a quality background. The work I was doing in the government, I was just telling you offside there a little bit, is was a special advisor for Spirit, and to really bring increase and improve morale it was in the public sector here, but how do we go about and do that work, and how do we explain to people that our workplace, people say, well, work stops at the door, or your life stops at the door, then you come in and you're just a worker bee, and then you put your coat on, you leave, and then your life starts again. It doesn't happen like that, does it, David?
No, I think one of the things that the workplace in particular has created a myth around work life and personal life and family life and social life and all of those sorts of things. And the myth is that there's a separation. And another part of the myth is that you can leave any part of yourself at the door, either going or coming. So, we take those things that happen at work, both good and bad, home. And we take the things at home, both good and bad, to work. And it's all life. So the question, I think, really becomes, how do we begin to create an experience of the workplace, that allows us to be, fully human and expressive, and in particular to create meaning for our work, meaning and purpose for our work. And then, of course, we would take that home, and I think most likely that would have very beneficial effects on home life as well.
I think so, and especially when you are in alignment with when your values are in alignment with your workplace and with the work that you're doing, and even the mission and vision of the company that you work for, and you feel good about that because it is in alignment, then lots of things just kind of fall into place. It's everything is lovely wherever you go, and you don't have to have this work-life balance thing that
At work, at that point, it's not work anymore. It turns out to be experience of life. And so I would guess, I would also say that I think each of us comes into life with what, there's a Sanskrit term called dharma, and it means duty or purpose, that sort of thing. And that if we can identify, our dharma and what it is that we're really here to do, and align with that, then I think we have an opportunity to turn work into a spiritual experience.
Yeah, because let's step back just for one moment, because I have to ask you, do you think that our purpose is to go to work from 9 to 5?
For a few, it may be. We never know exactly, how we're going to learn the lessons that we're here to learn in a lifetime. And, one way might be to be in a, in an awful situation, 9 to 5. But I would say for the vast majority of us, the answer is no. That we're just meant to do much more than that. It's not about picking up a paycheck and grinding our way, through many years, and one day we're lying on our deathbeds with lots of regret.
Mm-hmm. So you created this book, The New Agreements in the Workplace, because of your background. You look at systems, and you have your four agreements as well, and you have three masteries. So let's talk about the process and what you might do in an organization to help them evolve.
Well, one of the things that we see in the workplace in general, it's not just here in the U.S., but I would say worldwide, is that the vast majority of people who are leading and managing in the workplace are not what I call systems literate. And systems theory is very clear that 90% of the results that are created in the workplace are a function of the systems in which people work, not individual efforts. And so because leaders and managers are not aware of this fact, what they generally try to do is to get people to behave differently if they're trying to change things or improve things. And this has proved, of course, to be dramatically unsuccessful, because if the systems stay the same, you're going to get the same result, good or bad, within a range. And so one of the things that I think is absolutely critical in going into the workplace is to help people begin to, number one, realize the critical importance of their systems and processes, and secondarily, show them how to make them visible. Third, teach them how to identify the critical 20% of the variables that are controlling 80% of those systems. And then fourth, make whatever changes are necessary so we set the people up to be successful. And I really believe that's the job of leadership and management. And unless your system's literate, it's very, very difficult to really do what I would call a really comprehensive job as a leader or manager.
Right, I agree with that. Now, let's give an example of what we mean by systems, because some people listening may not come from a corporate background, and they may not understand systems, they may not have read Deming or anybody. So let's talk about, you have a great example actually in the book about the cafeteria.
Oh.
Right. Give that one.
Well, maybe what I should do is talk a little bit about the big picture first, then we'll talk about the cafeteria.
Okay.
If you look at nature, you'll see that everything in nature are systems and subsystems. And so if we look at the visible universe, what we see is a macro system, which is everything that we can see in the visible universe, and then everything is a subsystem of that. So we see clusters of galaxies, and then it moves into galaxies and like our Milky Way, and then solar systems like our sun and the planets. And it keeps moving on down until we actually get down to the molecular, atomic, and subatomic level. And everything works like that in the universe. It's the same is true in the workplace. What we find that everything that is happening in the workplace is either a system or a subsystem, although the vast majority of them are informal. What happens is people go into the workplace, they're trying to get the job done, and so they just create a way of doing it, and that becomes their system. So, but because it is informal and because it is the critical variables haven't been looked at, and maybe people, you know, have just been doing it the same way forever without really looking at how it could be improved, we get stuck with basically the same result.
We've always done it this way.
Exactly.
It a different way.
And it's comfortable. No matter how miserable it is, it's comfortable.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was just going to mention, the cafeteria. As an example, I was doing a presentation actually to a real fast-growing company, and I was trying to explain systems to their CEO and their CFO, and they were having a bit of trouble with it. But we decided we would go to lunch, and we sat down to eat, and the CEO, who was a very aggressive guy, he said, look, if you can't explain this system stuff, I'm not interested. And so I said, okay, let me tell you what just happened in your cafeteria. I said, I decided to have soup and salad. And I said, so I went through the soup line, and the first thing I did is I tried to reach underneath the splash guard, and I tried to put the soup in the bowl. But I said, I couldn't get the soup in the bowl because either the pots were too deep or the ladles were too long, and I ended up slopping the soup all over the place. And then, of course, you had a very good employee who ran over and cleaned all the mess up and that sort of thing. And then I went over and I went to pay for my soup and my salad, and it was taking a long time in line to pay for this, and I got up to the cashier. And the cashier was going to give me change, some $1 bills, back from the $5 or $10 bill that I gave them. And there's a little, I call it a doohickey, but there's a thing that comes down and holds the bills in place and allows you to pull one bill out at a time. And so this thing was not working properly, and every time the person tried to pull one bill out, all the bills came out at the same time, and he would fumble around and try and stuff them back in because he felt under pressure, I'm sure, to give everybody their change. And he dropped a couple of bills on the floor, and he had to go up the stool and pick them up. And anyway, he finally gave me, you know, my couple dollars change, and I walked out of there. But all of that, the spilled soup, and I can't get the soup in the bowl, and the napkins for cleaning up the spilled soup, and the standing in line, and the bills on the floor, and the guy having, you know, to run around stressing about the fact that he can't get the change to the people and that sort of thing, that's all created by systems problems. And it's totally invisible. Nobody sees it unless your system's literate. And so this goes on forever. And I'll finish the story with the funniest thing. I was actually doing a consulting job for a hospital, and I had told this story. This story's in the book. And so I went into the cafeteria with the CEO, and he was getting his salad at the salad bar, and the exact same thing happened, except this is a salad rather than soup. And he came to the table, he was laughing so hard, he says, "I cannot believe it. I just went through the exact same thing that you wrote about in the book." And I said, "Yep." But now he could see it because we were talking about the systems.
Right, and he was aware of it.
Yeah, it was, he really...
That's funny.
He says, "Oh my God, now I understand what you're talking about."
Well, if you want to look at a company that's really good with systems, it would have to be the post office. I mean, really, great. Well, maybe not there. Here, they're good.
Are they good in Canada?
They're very good in Canada, yeah.
Well,
they have a very good reputation for
well, let me tell you something.
We're not saying they're great.
I'm really excited for you in Canada because I don't think that's what's happening here in the U.S.
Wow. Well, it's got to be better than the horse and pony.
I'm not sure.
Really?
Oh,
wow.
That's awful.
That's the best way to describe it. That is awful. You know, well, your four agreements are find your purpose, grow and serve the frontline staff, be a systems thinker, and practice a little every day. Now, do you find that when you go into organizations, are they still top-down? Are they becoming more horizontal and where managers are now mentors and coaches? What are you finding today?
I think that in general, it's still very much top-down. It is still very much fear-based. It is there's a little bit of a caveat that I would say. I believe that we are entering a massive change, a dramatic acceleration in changing not only the workplace, but how we interact with each other in general. I just think that, you know, we're starting to wake up as a species, and that is going to be reflected in opportunities to make improvements and shifts both in the workplace and at home that we have never seen before. So I'm very optimistic, but I would say that in general, still, it's still very new to go in and find what I would call systems literate, even collaborative types of workplaces.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it was really interesting because when I was given my job as special advisor for Spirit, we had 60,000 employees, and they said, "I want you to make them happy, and I want you to improve morale, but we're not going to give you any more money." So I think that you were right on, and it was a great challenge, you know, how do you make people happy? You know, there's no money, so we're not going to raise your salary, but we're going to give you something. And so what I could give them was a change of perspective in how they felt about coming to work and changing. You know, I often you know, give the story about people who are in love and when you first fall in love and everything is just so rosy and wonderful and nothing could wreck your day, right? And then you have a fight with your new friend or your new lover and everything is you know, horrible. Same day, same people, but now your perspective is different.
Yeah.
You know, that perspective will change again depending upon how you choose to look at your day.
I think that's right on the money, Frankie. In the Toltec teachings, it's called point of view. And everything in the universe changes depending on your point of view. All you have to do is move 5 feet across the room and everything changes. So when you start to, you know, take it a little bit deeper and you find out that, you know, point of view is absolutely critical. Now, it takes awareness to shift a point of view normally, at least proactively. So then we're back to the masteries again, and the first and most important mastery of all is the mastery of awareness. If we are proactively trying to improve our lives, if we are trying to become more enlightened, if we are on some sort of a spiritual path, everything starts with awareness first. Without it, the mind runs the show and you get what you get.
Yeah. And awareness is listening to what your mind tells you, is listening to the messages that are going on with the board. I call them the board of directors inside your head.
It's watching your mind as an observer. So you watch your thoughts, beliefs, and memories, which is what makes up the mind. And normally it runs on free spool. You know, what happens is people say, well, I think this and I think that. So the truth is you don't think this or that. Your mind thinks this or that, and you identify with your mind. And since the mind creates our individual realities, at that point we're basically being dragged around through life by our minds. And if the mind happens to be thinking a lot of negative thoughts, you know, we'll have bad days. But let's say we were keeping an eye on it, and we start to think those negative thoughts, we could actually get to the point where we have choice, and we could say, well, you know what? I don't want to think those thoughts, and so I'm going to think some different ones that are based in love rather than fear.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you take this love into the workplace, into these engineers and people who think in terms of what's the word I'm looking for? I guess not quality, but what's the word? Ah, help me here, David. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm a little bit brave. Here, I'll explain to you. I had a manager once who was an engineer, and he and I said, well, he goes, well, how do you know? I go, because I feel it. I feel the difference, you know. And he goes, that's not good enough. I need data, hard data, you know, hard driven data, because he's an engineer. And I go, but there's some things that you can't quantify with just numbers, some things you just know and you feel, because, you know, now people say hello to one another where for a long time they wouldn't look at one another. And so these are things that are perceptible, but to a guy, you know, a numbers guy, it's not something that he's going to take as factual. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, you'll see there's actually four parts of the mind. Mm-hmm. And the part of the mind that has a need for data and logic and numbers and that sort of thing is called the masculine mind. And there's another part of the mind that's called the authoritarian mind. That's rules, regulations, and policy. And those two parts of the mind are the parts that run the workplace in general. But we have two other parts of ourselves. We have the feminine mind, which is feelings and memory and emotions and intuition and that sort of thing. And then we have the spiritual mind, which is our connection to nature and to higher purpose. And if you look in the workplace today, what you'll see is that the workplace is struggling not with the masculine and authoritarian minds. It is struggling to try and balance the feminine and spiritual minds. You know, we're all looking for teamwork, and we're all looking for creativity, and we're all looking for purpose and vision. And those things do not exist in the masculine and authoritarian mind. So what we have to do is begin to balance with these other parts of ourselves. Now, with an engineer, I'll just speak, you know, for myself, in working with people, you know, that are what I would call, you know, left brain, very logical, maybe very structured in the way they live their lives, that sort of thing. I would create lots of space for somebody like that. And what I would normally try to do is to work with a group where we begin to create an energy field. And everything in the universe is energy. And
yeah.
It's with a little bit of a catalyst, we can begin to create an energy field that comes from love and support or whatever we want to call that. And that does the work, whether or not the mind is sitting back there, running its number. And so I actually call it, I think in the book I described it as like popcorn. We'll have a group and there'll be, the engineers and maybe the people that are, think this is really a, they don't know what it is. And they'll always be sitting near the exits, by the way. And so, yeah, always. You can watch. They'll always be back in the corners by the exits. And so all you do is you just start to do the work. You create lots of space so that these people, don't feel threatened. And you just begin to do the work. And what you'll begin to see is you'll see people begin to, literally, it's like a wake up. They go, oh, my God. They literally start to see the world in a little different way. And it's just like popcorn. Now they add a little bit to the energy field, and, pretty soon it's almost palatable in the room. And that energy does the work. It does the transformational work. And it does it perfectly in that you don't have to figure out how much or who or anything. All you have to do is, keep the mind occupied doing something that is useful. And so, that's what you do. You work with people doing something that's useful and keeps the mind busy, but at the same time, you're just basically working with them to create, these energy fields, which end up doing the work.
So we have these four agreements and three masteries. We talked about the first mastery, the mastery of awareness. The second one is now the mastery of transformation. So, mm-hmm. So now we're moving towards the transformation. And the third one is the mastery of intent.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, the mastery of transformation, first you become aware. That's the mastery of awareness. The second mastery is the mastery of transformation, where you're actually proactively changing your thoughts, beliefs, and memories. And with practice, this becomes actually very easy to do. And, of course, when you change, the contents of the mind, things where the emotional energy of the mind is based in fear or anger or, that sort of thing, to something that's based in love, support, or compassion, then you begin, basically, that's what you begin to experience in life because the mind is creative. And then the final mastery is called the mastery of intent. It could also be called the mastery of love or the mastery of energy. And this is where you actually begin to use energy in positive ways, to help people, make the changes that they're trying to make. So it's go ahead.
Do you take the word love into the workplace, David? Do you use the word love to these CFOs and COOs?
No, normally I don't. And the reason I don't is because, number one, love brings up anything unlike itself. And so if it's a term that people have trouble with, my question would be, why create fear? So rather than calling it love, I would look at what would be acceptable for the workplace that I happen to be working with. Maybe they like support, or they like teamwork, or they like something like that. Well, then, the last thing we really want to do is to create more fear. So we try to use the language that will be acceptable and normal for whichever workplace you're working with.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. That's really great. As long as the work is getting done, it really doesn't matter what name you give it, does it?
Yeah, if we're trying to push our agenda on someone, then it's our problem, not theirs.
That's right. But they're calling for this transformation. They're calling for change. They may not know what that change is or what it's going to feel like, but they know that something needs to happen. Obviously, because you're there.
Yeah, well, everybody's for change until you begin to change.
Yeah, well, the fear of things being different, the fear of coming out of that so-called comfort zone, and yet change can't happen within it. So we have to come out of it to do any of that work. So do they understand about the fear? Do they understand that they're working in a fear-based society? Do they do at the top, do they understand this, or do you use other words?
Well, I would use the words that would be appropriate for the workplace that we're in. Like, for instance, in some workplaces, if you talk about fear or you talk about repression or use words like that, that really would create more fear in that particular mm-hmm. workplace. So if it were, you might use words like communication or teamwork. In other words, the last thing I think we want to do as teachers in the workplace is to create more of what it is that we are trying to work our way through.
The alienation and fear.
Yeah.
I found that communication is, there's good communication probably between the president and the vice president, between the vice president and directors, and between directors and managers, the first line manager, but somewhere it gets really muddled and lost, and the people at the front never get the clarity of why they're there and what their business is and what the mission. I mean, if I would go around to any company, and I would challenge many companies to say, do you know what the mission and vision statement of your company is? They probably don't know.
Well, even
if
they
knew. If you don't know that, how do you know if you fit in?
You knew, for the vast majority of workplaces, it's just conceptual.
Well, they're not living it, are they? They're not living it.
Yeah, in other words, there's no strong emotional tie to, the vision or the mission. It's just something that, has been created by corporate and been trying to, they try to sell that to people. But, of course, in order for something, for people to have a real mission or a real vision, it has to have meaning for them. And so you've got to move beyond the conceptual. You've got to move into something that, resonates with the individuals who are doing the work.
And that's why when I work with people, I like to ask them what they think their values are. And if you understand what your values are and you know what your company does and you know your position and why you're at that company and how you're making that company, see the vision. Like you take the commercials that Saturn does. It seems that the people who work for Saturn understand their company. They're proud to work for the company and what the company stands for and what they do, and it makes them feel really good about themselves that they're helping, be a part of this vision.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that be wonderful if everybody went to work and felt really proud to be where they work and understand their role in the workplace and why it's so great for them to go to work and just their little piece in the cog is very important to the whole. And so everybody is really important because everybody has a job to do. And whether you're the president or the mailroom clerk, it doesn't matter because your job is just as important as the others.
Exactly. And what you're describing is, a workplace where there is meaning that is created for the people. But the important thing to remember is that meaning does not come from the organization. That meaning is created inside out with each individual that works there.
That's true, but it becomes the culture. And like you say, you can go into a workplace and you can sit down and you can just feel the culture. You can feel the vibration of the place and know if it's a place that you'd like to be or not be. Know if you even want to be a customer of them or not.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever done that? You walk into a restaurant or you walk into a lobby and go, I don't know about this place.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. And
that's
people are always happy,
yeah.
And it's like, ooh, I wouldn't want to work here. And yeah. And even, even in the government, when I first moved to like McDonald Block, and it was like the carpet was threadbare, and I sat in a chair that was half broken because they had this idea, this antiquated idea that government shouldn't spend money on its employees because that money is very important, and people give money to the government, and so we shouldn't waste it. And yet, it's very important, the business of government and the business of administration. And why should people who work there have to sit in broken chairs? Because if you worked in another company, in corporate America or Canada, wherever, you wouldn't be sitting in a broken chair.
Yeah.
People can't do good work sitting in broken chairs. They can't do good work when they're, they're not ergonomically in place. And so it's a silly idea to think you're saving money because you're not really saving money because you're not getting the best out of people.
Yeah, well, the thing that we see an awful lot in the workplace in general is that people are pretty good at accounting for price, but people are very poor in general at accounting for real cost. And so, you know, we do things like we become very penny wise and pound foolish. And we see this constantly. You know, we'll go into a company and they're trying to save money, and so they buy the the cheapest supplies that they can buy. But when you really look at the overall cost of using, you know, these cheaper supplies, it turns out to be much higher than if you were to spend a little more and buy the right things. And so it's the same way. We find that when we lay people off, for example, if you don't have an ability to look at your systems, in many cases, the layoffs will stress already somewhat dysfunctional systems, and you will save very little money even with extensive layoffs because your costs go up when the systems become more stressed. And so that becomes, you know, you still have to do the same amount of work, but now you have less people and your systems haven't changed. So, you know, these traditional things that people do, you know, and in downturns, you know, cut 10%, because that's easy. Anybody can do that. But to understand what your costs are and to understand your systems and to do the right thing, now that requires real leadership.
Very impressive. You know, you you did something very exciting. You took a spiritual journey. You take people on a spiritual journey. And is it Teotihuacan? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Teotihuacan.
Yeah, that's
pyramids outside of Mexico City, and that the term actually means where one becomes God or where one becomes enlightened. And that was the city that was built by the ancient Toltecs for the express purpose of practicing, sometimes over decades, to become realized beings. So
let's talk
about
the Toltecs for a moment, because you must have a bit of history about them. Who were they, and what happened to them?
Well, the ancient Toltec, they came into being around 4,000 years ago, and people think that they were a tribe. They actually weren't. They were a group of what I would call thought leaders. They were scientists and engineers and teachers. And these were people that came together to work together on what we would call a spiritual path. And the term Toltec actually means person of knowledge. And so the Toltecs were seekers. And they were, of course, seeking enlightenment. And so they built Teotihuacan as the place to practice. And that city at one time was the largest city in central Mexico. And these people, sometimes over decades, would go through all of the various processes in order to become realized beings. And supposedly, you know, at the end of the time, they would have a choice of whether they wanted to stay here and teach or whether they basically wanted to go back to what they called the center of the universe. So, or we might call it heaven. Who knows what we would call it, but something like that. But
what happened to them? Did people start to fear them? Did they start to
of course, over a long period of time like that, they had many different things happen. At some points, they were being persecuted for their beliefs, and then at one point, there were barbarians that came down from the north, and they invaded, and the Toltec resisted as best they could. And finally what happened, the Toltec decided that it was unwise to continue with Teotihuacan and with their ancient history and that sort of thing. And so they buried all of Teotihuacan, the pyramids. These are huge pyramids. They buried it all, and it was, of course, only recently when I say more recently, it was discovered and people started digging them out. But the Toltec, basically, they dispersed into, you know, various parts of Mexico. Some of them made their way up here, and, they continued to teach and they continued to learn and to do that sort of thing. But the Aztecs followed them, and then the Aztecs didn't quite understand what the Toltec teachings really were, and so they got into things like sacrifice and so forth, which were never a part of the Toltec teachings. And
the core of their teaching then is self knowledge. Is that what
yeah.
it is? Or?
It would be very much like someone who went to live in an ashram for many years in order to become spiritually awake.
Okay, okay. So how many times have you been there?
Oh, quite a few. I went there, I don't know, probably 6 or 8 times with Miguel, and we used to do some teaching when we were down there. We would take people through the pyramids and teach and that sort of thing. But I had maybe my most powerful experience of my entire life at the top of the Pyramid of the Sun about 12 years ago, and it actually changed me physically. And I came off the pyramid, and Miguel knew instantly, you know, what had happened. And that was the day that he told me he was no longer my teacher, that it was time for me to teach. And so I've been teaching.
What happened? How did you feel? What went on? How did
well,
you know?
I really don't talk about it. I do talk about it on the journey because we take people to the top of the pyramid, you know, as a part of that whole process, taking them through the process
right.
that the ancient Toltecs went through. But I can say that I will just make this statement that anyone who has an experience of your mind stopping and the experience of who we are beyond the mind, mm-hmm. We will spend the rest of our lives trying to get back to that point. It's so profound.
Wow.
So along those lines. Yeah.
So you're going back, you were just there, when, in January?
We were just there in January, and it's my first return to Teotihuacan in 12 years, and so I didn't even know what to expect. But it was even more powerful than I remembered it. It was just,
really?
I believe the place is coming alive at the same time that we were experiencing this acceleration in the world, you know, toward, you know, waking up to who we are.
How far away is it from where you are?
Well, we're in San Diego, but it's about an hour northeast of Mexico City.
Okay, and so you're taking another tour there, a group there on May 14th to 19th?
Yeah, we're going to go, and I've actually been surprised because I didn't know what to expect, but it turns out that I guess people are kind of hungry for this sort of thing, which I'm happy about. But, we had just an incredible group, and looks like we'll have another one.
How many people?
Our first one was 12, and we'll probably have maybe a few more than that this time. But it's going to be limited. I believe it'll probably grow to 30, but that'll be the limit because I want to make sure that I'm able to stay with the entire group the entire time. I feel that's important.
So approximately how much would it cost for people to join you?
It's $12.95, and that includes room and great food and the pyramids and pretty much everything except the flight.
Great. That sounds awesome. And that's for 5 days.
It's for 5 days in the pyramids, and there's actually a lot of stuff that goes on when we're not there as well, but it's a very much a spiritual journey.
Yeah, and I hear that everybody has a life altering experience.
That's what we've been told. We had a little group of 12, and I think all 12 of them feel like their life was changed profoundly in those 5 days.
How amazing! Now, your wife Linda she's a dream coach, isn't she?
Well, she's a spiritual coach. You know, she teaches, you know, four agreements and new agreements and universal principles, and she does dream work and character types, which is another thing that we teach. And she's special. I always tell everybody we do workshops and that sort of thing too, and I can stand up in front of the room and be, you know, brilliant for days on end, and at the end of these things, everybody's crowded around Linda.
That's funny. Well, because she's pretty.
Oh, she's gorgeous, but, I mean, she's even prettier on the inside than she is on the outside.
Yeah.
She's an angel.
Wow. Now, you're starting to really looking in the area of healthcare. I think you're focusing on healthcare. Are you?
Yeah. For the last, about 5 years ago, I got a call from a hospital, and they had implemented the four agreements in their chemotherapy department, and it's gone very well. And then they tried to take it outside of chemotherapy, and it just fell on its face. And so they asked me if I might be able to help them take it out into the hospital. And I said I thought I could. And that also we might want to look at some of the new agreements as, you know, something that would even enhance what they were trying to do. So they took a flyer on me. I had never done any work in a hospital, but the systems works all the same, you know. Mm-hmm. So, we turned the whole hospital around, and the word kind of got out, and the next thing I knew, there was another hospital and another hospital. And, I spent 5 years really working in healthcare and really came to understand the challenges in our healthcare system. The best way I can describe it is it's simply broken. And it's going to have to change because it is not sustainable the way it is right now.
Well, it seems to be broken here, too. And I have a hard time understanding in some ways, you know, how quality organizations who ascribe to a quality model can be so deficient in their system.
Well, as near as I can tell, the culture in healthcare, at least here in the U.S., is it's different. Yeah, than I've seen in other workplaces. We've done a lot of work in many different workplaces, but in healthcare it's a little different. And I would say that in healthcare there is more rigidity, there is more separation between people doing different jobs, there is a culture of silence, there is a culture of sweeping things under the rug rather than facing issues, and I would say that if 1 in 100 hospitals is even slightly systems literate, I would be surprised. So they basically have this monstrosity that has been created that is so inefficient, and the systems are so dysfunctional and so costly as to be remarkable. So I have a feeling.
Do they ever agree on who their customer is?
Well, they agree intellectually. I mean, everybody is focused on the patient, supposedly. But when you start to look at how might we really be able to solve some of the problems we have in healthcare, we've got to start focusing on the care providers so they can focus on taking care of the patients. And that means fixing the systems, because the systems right now are nothing but a monstrous series of workarounds. They're these informal systems, and basically it's become so normal. They're like fish in water. Everybody runs from hither and yon, you know, to try and hold these systems together. It's just a rat race, and the people who have to work in those systems, they're stressed, they're tired, in many cases they're burnt out. And this is at the same time that, you know, we've got 80 million baby boomers that are just about ready to dive into the healthcare system.
Yeah, pretty scary stuff. And that works, too, for business because, you know, even in businesses, we've got, you know, the boomers, the sandwich generation who have to leave work for their parents and they have to leave work for their kids. And some flexibility needs to happen for them so that they don't just put a gun to their head and shoot themselves and say, I can't deal anymore.
Yeah. Well, I think in general, I'll just speak, for the U.S., I mean, we are a very stressed society. And, of course, stress creates disease.
Yep.
And, we see a lot of that. I mean, and we do, for some reason, we have a very difficult time taking decent care of ourselves. You know, it's like we just allow ourselves to start running around, whether it's at work or at home, under what I would call very stressful conditions. And, you know, there's really not a break for an awful lot of Americans.
That's true. And the answer is?
And the answer is, wake up.
Yeah, wake up.
Be
kind to yourself.
Yeah, the mind.
Self-love would be good.
Well, the mind's just dragging us through life. And we don't have any choices. You know, we don't realize that, you know, we get up in the morning, the alarm goes off, and we race around, and, you know, we just, the mind is literally dragging us through life, and we don't have any choices, so we can't change our reality. We just get what we get.
Yeah, what a shame. Isn't it great when you can flip that switch and go, gee, I do have choices. I can stop. I don't have to live here if I don't want to. I don't even have to work there if I don't want to. You know, and
yeah.
I can choose to live a different lifestyle. I can choose, okay, so maybe I don't have my Porsche, but you know what? I get the trade-off is I'm happy. I don't have stress. The cortisol isn't, you know, running through my belly, and I'm not going to get cancer and all of these other wonderful things.
One of the things that Miguel used to say, and I always thought it was so profound, he said, the purpose of life is to be happy and fully human.
Yeah. How many people know what happiness is and what it means? And, you know, it's an experience. It's not, you know, for some people, it's an hour in a day instead of, you know, or hour once a year. Oh, I was happy once. You know, I saw happiness in some visceral experience, you know, rather than just becoming a happy person.
Mm-hmm. Well, we actually are happy people. We're all of us, if we once get past the identification with the mind, we're even beyond happy. I mean, we are, you know, it's ecstatic spiritual beings having a human experience.
Yeah, we are.
So
we in these bodies, we need to feel the things that we came here to feel.
Yeah.
But we felt them, so now we can change.
We can.
Thanks very much for the experience. We're going to change that now. Yeah, let's download something new and different. So what's new for David Dibble? What's on your horizon?
Well, I think I'm going to do, I made a big, I guess, I don't even want to call it a change. It's like I took a long look at my life and what I was doing, and I decided I'm only going to do things that I really enjoy. And so one of the things that I've decided to do less of is systems work in places where there's a lot of fear. Because it requires, in order to take good care, I'll speak for myself, in order to take good care of myself, I have to be on alert constantly so that my mind, you know, doesn't take things personally and doesn't, you know, get sucked in to that negativity. And that's the thing that you find. I mean, it's great because we get lots of opportunity to practice in these toxic environments, but it's not that much fun. So
yeah.
I just decided, you know, I'm not going to do it anymore. And the only people I'm going to work with on systems is people that, you know, that want, they really do want to change. It'll have to be at the CEO level on down. And that the people that, you know, really want to grow and are willing who are warriors, you know, who are willing to face their fears in order to be better. And, you know, those people are still somewhat rare, but it's very interesting. Once I made that choice, I noticed that the kindred spirits are starting to show up. So,
I don't get that. Yeah. I've been running to you.
Like you.
Well, thank you. You know, I think that people seem to be coming in droves at the moment for me. And I know that, you know, as you know, the energy you put out is what you attract and who's going to come and see you. But there does seem to be an awakening, and like a mass awakening. And it's not surprising because it's supposed to be, but, you know, people who are always surprised that, oh, gee, you know, you wouldn't believe who I met today, and you know, they believe this. I'm like, well, yeah, of course you did. and so, you know, I mean, it's so interesting that I'm meeting people that you know and you're meeting people that I know, and how exciting is that? Because there's all this work that needs to be done by people like us.
Yeah, my experience has been recently I have never experienced so many kindred spirits showing up. I've been at this now for almost 30 years, and you know, it's not to say that there haven't been some really, you know, wonderful people that have showed up in my life. There's been many. But not like this. You know, the phone rings and a connection is made. I mean, even this trip to Tao, I mean, I found that the connections are just coming from everywhere now. So I just believe that it's time. You know, this is the time we've been waiting for, and all the work that we've done to get to this point is so that, you know, we can be of assistance as we now enter in these, you know, these really profound moments of change. And, you know, our real work, I think, is just beginning.
Well, you certainly prepared for it. I mean, you're a pioneer, and you've been waiting for your students, and they're here now. So congratulations to you on that, on being so
receptive
to do the work before you needed to. And it's just so lovely to talk to you. And you just got such a wonderful book. David Dibble is the author of The New Agreements in the Workplace and The New Agreements in the Healthcare. And you can find his books on Amazon, www.amazon.com. And, David, your website is?
The www.thenewagreements.com.
There you go. Thank you so much. We've already run out of time. Wow, an hour goes so fast when you're having a good time. But, David, thanks so much. And I really enjoyed speaking to you. And best of luck in the future. And I know that we're going to be seeing each other, so it's going to be great.
Thanks so much, Frankie. We'll talk soon.
You take care. Have a wonderful evening. Bye now.
Bye. Bye.